and Americans for the Arts.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up, we'll hear a replay of Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV. And then later on, we'll open up the phone lines and talk about some of the issues in the news. First, one listener comment about last Friday's radio program. Last Friday, we, for a brief time, talked about the president's rally in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And here's what one listener had to say following last Friday's show.
Hi, my name's Ernie from Port Richey. After listening to the show Friday, I thought of something. I think that progressive causes might gain more support if those on the fence didn't hear chants like no Trump, no wall, no USA at all, or if they didn't see Antifa protesters waving communist flags. All right, thank you.
That was a listener comment that came in after Friday's radio program. Well, we're going to hear a TV program right now. It's a discussion about state and local politics. It's called Florida This Week. It's on the PBS station WEDU-TV, and it features local people talking about some of the state and local issues that are going on around Florida. So here is Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU. Coming up next, the governor proposes raising starting teacher pay in Florida. A year after Hurricane Michael, there are still people left homeless by the storm. A federal judge is skeptical about the way the legislature wrote the law to restore felon voting rights. And why are Democratic presidential candidates skipping this weekend's statewide party convention? Political Insights next on Florida This Week. Welcome back. This week, our panelists are Holly Gregory is an anchor and political reporter at Spectrum Bay News 9. Mike Fasano is the Pasco County tax collector and a Republican. Rita Ferrandino is the CEO and founder of ARC Capital and a Democrat. And Tara Newsom is an attorney and a professor of political science at St. Petersburg College. Well, it's great to see you. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Governor Ron DeSantis is promising to ask the legislature to increase the minimum starting salary for public school teachers to $47,500 a year. Right now, the average teacher starting salary in Florida is just under $39,000. That's almost last, 46th in the nation. If approved, the plan would make new teachers among the best paid in the country. About 100,000 teachers statewide would receive a raise under the proposal. Teachers in the state have been fleeing the profession. There are more than 3,000 unfilled teaching jobs currently statewide. The proposal raises many questions, including, will the legislature go along? Would veteran teachers also get a raise? How would it be paid for? Would the state pick up the estimated $603 million tab, or would the state mandate that the cost be picked up by local school districts? And what would happen to the existing teacher bonus program? So, Rita, I want to ask all those questions during this round, but let me start with this. Does this solve the problem for teachers here in the state of Florida that we're having people leave the profession and we've got thousands of openings of unfilled teacher jobs in the state?
No, this does not solve the problem of our teacher shortage here in Florida or across the country, but thank God we're talking about it. So I am excited that the governor is bringing this to the table, because today we have 3,000 classrooms without teachers in them. That's pathetic. We have to start addressing this. Here in Florida, we have had this mass exodus that's much worse than other places around the country, and it's because we are known in this state for poor treatment of teachers, poor pay, and the teacher bonus program was a large part of the problem that caused this big cascade of problems. So we have to start addressing it, and I applaud, at least we're starting to have the conversation. No, the governor's plan does not go anywhere far enough to solving the problem, but let's start somewhere.
Mike, I think it's fair to say that since the days of Governor Jeb Bush, the public school system has not been the favorite of Republicans in Tallahassee. And I think some people are pretty shocked that a Republican governor would now say, hey, we want to substantially raise the incoming pay for teachers, for public school teachers.
And understandably so. And I give enormous amount of credit to Governor DeSantis for coming up with this idea. The $64 million question is really the $600-plus million question. Who's going to pay for it? And will it be continued? The bottom line is, as you remember, Governor Scott was big on education in his first year as a governor of the state, and then from there it was downhill. Let's hope if this is a start that it continues to go forward in a positive way. But is the legislature going to be able to come up with $600 million? And will it even be more than $600 million? And again, who pays for it? Tallahassee or your local school district? And as you know, the legislature in the past has always increased education in some form or fashion and put a lot of the impact, fiscal impact, on local school districts.
So,
That's where I see the real problem, because after Parkland shooting, we saw that financing the resource officers that came with our, you know, response to Parkland, that laid onto the local communities. They can't necessarily shoulder that burden. You can't place the mantle of expanding our costs of attracting good quality teachers on the local community. It would be an unfunded mandate. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that with DeSantis' approval, the legislature will look at this and then try to find ways to fund it.
Yeah. Holly, I saw a quote from the incoming Speaker of the House, Chris Sprouls, who said that the legislature has a spending problem, and he's kind of like indicated that he wants to cut spending. So this would be the wrong time, I think, to ask Sprouls for a $600 million increase.
Well, and that was echoed just an hour after the news conference by DeSantis. You had Jose Oliva put out a statement that was less than enthusiastic about all this. I'm paraphrasing, but basically that statement said, okay, thank you, Governor, but you've already proposed $2 billion worth of spending, and we're going to stick to a tight budget. Mm-hmm. So he kind of threw cold water on the whole thing right out of the gate. Now, we carried his news conference live. The governor made this announcement at several places across the state, but he also came here to Dunedin, to his alma mater, to make this announcement. And he basically said, when asked that question, who's going to pay for it, and it was pretty vague. He said, well, we've crunched the numbers, and it's not pie in the sky. But what that actually means is that $64 million question.
And, and again, we're at least starting to talk about the fact that we have 3,000 classrooms without teachers in it. I mean, at some point you have to put a stake in the ground and say, we've got a real problem here and we got to solve it. Let's figure it out.
So if you raise the base pay, or the average pay for teachers starting salaries, you've also, I think, would have to raise the pay for the veteran teachers too, because they're looking
at you have to have parity. You need certification programs. There's a lot of ways we've got to attack this problem.
And the governor said, okay, if we raise the base pay to $47.5 for starting teachers, that takes us from 26th in the nation for starting pay to second in the nation. And it would also, he says, raise the pay for about 100,000 teachers, or 60% of the workforce of the teachers, because if you're making less than that, you'd be bumped up to it. However, if you're a veteran teacher who's been in the business 15 years and you're making $48,000, all of a sudden some newbie comes in and is making, you know, is the same as you or maybe even more. And he addressed that by saying, we're not done yet. We need to look at the best and brightest. And there's been legislation already introduced to repeal that.
That's
it's never been popular.
That's the bonus program.
Right. And teachers, veteran teachers, would much rather see raises rather than bonuses, especially the way that one's structured.
Yeah, this teacher bonus program's really a problem, and it should go away.
All right, so Rob Bradley, Republican, has introduced that legislation, Holly, that you mentioned, that would repeal the Best and the Brightest program. There's $300 million in that program, so that gets you almost halfway to where you need to be if you repeal it.
But is the $300 million continuous? Is it just one time a year that they put this money in the bonus program? Remember, if you raise teacher salaries, and I hope they do, they are desperately needing more money. They're excellent people, hardworking individuals. But you have to find money that's going to be every year. A teacher's bonus program is just put in the budget once each year, mm-hmm. not every year.
And so you've got to find recurring
dollars, and that's the key. There's non-recurring and there's recurring. This is a recurring impact on the state of Florida. And if it's put down on the school districts, guess what? they're going to have to go and find those dollars. And guess what? Property taxes are going to increase.
Mike, how can you tell whether or not the governor's serious on this? I mean, because you've been in the legislature. You were up there in Tallahassee for years.
Yes.
How can we tell if the governor's serious and whether or not there's going to be a lot of pushback from the legislature?
Well, one, the governor, I think, is dead serious. I think he truly is sincere. But he also knows that a governor can throw out any budget he or she wants to. It's the legislature that now has to take that budget and fine-tune it because they only get so many dollars from the taxpayers to use in that fiscal year.
Okay. Well, at a hearing this week in Tallahassee, a federal judge raised serious constitutional questions about the legislature's implementation of Amendment 4, saying that lawmakers created a mess that has left felons afraid to register to vote.
The American Civil Liberties Union and other groups are challenging the implementation law in court. Amendment 4 was supposed to reverse a 150-year-old state law and restore the right to vote to most felons in Florida who completed all terms of sentence, including probation and parole. But Florida's Republican-controlled legislature passed a law this year requiring ex-felons to pay all fines, fees, and court costs before registering to vote. This week, the federal judge said lawmakers had created a system that kept people from voting who couldn't afford to ever pay back those fees. A 2005 federal appeals court ruling said access to voting cannot depend on an individual's financial resources. The judge is expected to issue a final ruling in the next few weeks.
Okay, Tara, the judge is expressing skepticism from the bench, but we don't know what his final decision will be. Let's just say, theoretically, that he rules against the legislature and says, look, this was not the intent of the voters, and this may be a tax that would be unconstitutional. Where would it go next? Where would the issue go?
I think where it would go is implementation of the voters' intent, and then voters would be, or felons would be able to register to vote. The problem also lies in the applicability of how the form for felons to register is being implemented. There's a new form for felons, and there's three categories. And if you actually make an error on it, it's a third-degree felony punishable by 5 years and a $5,000 fine. So the effect of the judge, who has great case precedent, and of course the 24th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution that asks for no financial burden to put on anyone who wants to exercise their right to franchise or the right to vote, is very plausible that he'll say, hey, wait a minute, these fees are equal to a financial burden that was denied both by Johnson v. Bush, which is the case that you referenced, that said you can't have a financial burden, as well as the 24th Amendment that says you can't have a financial burden. We all know that to be poll taxes, right? And so it seems reasonable that Judge Henkel will say, hey, these fees look an awful lot like a poll tax. It is a burden, and we can't do that. Even if he does set it aside and we go forward with the implementation of Amendment number 4, the chilling effect has already occurred. Felons are worried, they're scared. That's 1.4 million individuals in the state of Florida. But I think there's some hope. The University of Florida looked at over 40 counties, and they saw that in those 40 counties, there's only about 20% of the felons who would be eligible to vote if this law was applied. Okay, but that 20% is roughly over 200,000 to 300,000 people, all right? Those people still could exercise the right to vote in the 2020 election, and the practical impact could be, you know, the swing state swinging a different way.
Meaning that they've already registered to vote, so therefore that
they've paid all their restitution and fees. And so even if the law were to continue, they could continue to vote. There's no way that any of the supervisor of elections and clerks can actually determine who is a felon and who isn't and who has paid their restitution. So that's another practical problem that we're facing. So,
and Holly, that is one of the problems, is that we don't know who's paid their fines and who's not. There's not like an agency that looks statewide as who's paid and who's not. And then this question of, well, do you search every voter's background to find out whether or not they're a felon? And I mean, you'd have to create an enormous bureaucracy to kind of police this.
And we interviewed the Hillsborough state attorney about this. He brought up the idea of creating the rocket docket to get folks on the fast track to figure out, okay, what do you owe? Could we possibly work that off through community service? And you know what they found out very quickly is we can't even, there's no database. This is so all over the place as to you know, how much do people owe? Have they paid any of it? How much do they still owe? Those folks don't know, and there's no real tracking of it. So for the judge to call this an administrative nightmare, you can certainly understand. It's like, where would you even start to know how to pay and how much you owe to begin with.
But what was really interesting is when they tried to exercise that discussion about Rocket Docket, the idea was $10 an hour per community service. So if you have a $25,000 fine, that was an illusory kind of solution. And so
I think it would take forever to pay it off.
The judge really poked holes at any kind of solution, and other than trying to have enabling legislation that didn't look like this at all.
Mike, do you think the legislature, though, if the judge does come out against the implementation law in the state, that the legislature would appeal this to a higher court?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I would imagine that they may, and of course that would go to the appellate court, and then maybe beyond that to the U.S. Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. One of the things the legislature needs to you know, get the grasp on all of this, and that is the people voted this. It was voted overwhelming. The intent of the people is to allow these individuals who have done what they were supposed to do to be able to vote, to be able to participate in the electoral process. And it's not like it was a close election. This constitutional amendment passed overwhelmingly. And it's kind of sad that some of my colleagues in Tallahassee don't understand this.
Mm-hmm. I think that's just the whole thing is just infuriating. You know, the will of the people is being stifled by the state legislature. We've got, you know, Florida's only one of three states that have this ridiculous felon penalty and can't vote anyway. So I'd love to see this all.
I have to tell you, I'm a little more concerned about making sure that the victims are compensated
sure.
as well. Making sure, that the individual, the person who's paid all that they are supposed to pay, also include restitution as well, or making some sort of a try, if you will. But the bottom line is the people said these individuals should be able to have their constitutional rights back and be able to vote. Give them that opportunity. Let them make that choice.
Yeah, my sense is of reading the news stories about this is that the judge, if he decides against the legislature, he's going to toss it back to the legislature to ask them to rewrite the bill. That's
sure,
my sense.
Separation of powers. That's,
yeah.
that's
the, he's not going to legislate from the bench. He doesn't
right.
want to do that.
That's
a judge not doing that? I'm sure.
But 8 of the 12 circuit courts all supported Johnson v. Bush, which is the court case that affirmed that you cannot use financial obstacles to vote. So that's a pretty significant case precedent. So for Judge Henkel to overturn that would be significant.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, you're listening to a replay of Florida This Week from this past Friday night, a panel discussion about state and local politics. And my guests on that panel were Holly Gregory with Bay News 9, a reporter, Rita Ferrandino, a Democrat from Sarasota, Mike Fasano, the tax collector in Pasco County, he's the Republican on the panel, and Tara Newsom is a professor and lawyer. She teaches at St. Pete College. And we've already heard about a possible pay increase for starting teachers, public school teachers in Florida, and also about a judge kind of frowning on the implementation law of Amendment 4. We'll see what his decision is soon. And if you want to comment about any of the topics here, you can email us in the studio, dj@wmnf.org. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Now here is more of Florida This Week.
Well, it's been a year since Hurricane Michael roared ashore and devastated a wide area of the panhandle. Bay County, the county hardest hit by the Cat 5 storm, is still facing a crisis.
Thousands in Bay County are still homeless. Medical care and housing are scarce. And officials say domestic violence has been on the rise. Michael was among the strongest hurricanes ever to make landfall in the U.S., hitting with 160-mile-an-hour winds, ripping homes from their foundations and devastating parts of Panama City, Mexico Beach, and Tyndall Air Force Base. It left 22,000 of Bay County's population homeless.
Holly, you witnessed and covered the destruction. What lessons can we take from this
goodness.
A year later?
Yes. You know, we went up there 2 days before it hit, and then we stayed a week after for the recovery, and I've never seen anything like it. I mean, even the pictures don't do it justice because it was just so many miles wide, this destruction. And then all week long, this past week leading up to the anniversary, we've had our crew there. We've been interviewing, you know, elected officials, and just something to think about in Bay County alone right now, or in Panama City. In Panama City, 60% of the housing was wiped out. Mm. 9,000 people still have not returned. That's 25% of the population there. So as they try to open businesses, they don't have a workforce. Mm-hmm. There's no affordable housing. Rent has gone through the roof because of the shortage of the housing. We interviewed the mayor of Panama City Beach, and he said this is a lingering catastrophe. It has not ended yet. It is still just a disaster.
Did the mayor say what needed to be done next, either by state officials or by insurance companies or by the federal government?
As far as the federal government goes, for example, Panama City, just in debris removal, has spent $75 million, and there's still debris that they're moving, removing a year later. And of that $75 million, FEMA has reimbursed $15. So he was not critical, though. I mean, Panhandle is very, friendly to President Trump, and President Trump visited Panama City Beach shortly after. So he was stopping short of being critical of the help that is coming from the federal government. But he said it's the whole process is just, you know, like molasses. It's so slow to get these reimbursements. And, I mean, they're struggling, to say the least.
Mike, one of the problems, too, is that the insurance companies are not paying up in a timely fashion. Part of the debate on the insurance company's part is that one insurance company will say, well, your damage is from water. And the household owner will say, no, it's from wind. And the one insurance company will cover water damage, but the other will cover wind damage. And no insurance company is taking responsibility.
Shame on the insurance companies. Shame on our those in Tallahassee, the leaders in Tallahassee, for not speaking up. This has been going on with insurance companies forever here in the state of Florida, whether it be sinkholes, wind damage, water damage. And now the devastation that we see up in the Panhandle, those poor people, they paid their premiums. So when this damage occurred, they thought it would be, they would be able to get reimbursed. They would be able to put in a claim, and that claim would be taken care of. And to know now, after all this time, that still we have insurance companies fighting these individuals who have no place to go. But and the insurance companies are being allowed to get away with it. And shame on Tallahassee for allowing this to happen.
But Mike, isn't that the job of the insurance commissioner that
Absolutely.
We have here in Florida? I mean,
Absolutely.
What's he doing?
I don't know. And this is where they're not stepping up to the plate. Whether it be the insurance company commissioner, our CFO, any other member of the cabinet, there's no one in Tallahassee speaking up for these individuals. And you know why? Because those people who have been hit by these storms give very little, if anything, to the political campaigns. The insurance companies of this country donate millions of dollars to political campaigns and to political parties, and that's why they have a bigger say.
And that's shameful.
Shameful is right.
So we've got a federal government that's taking no action, and we've got a state government that's taking no action.
As far as I can see, they aren't. And but you do hear once in a while, a million came in, few million here, few million there. It's going to take a lot more than a few million to help those people.
Okay, so you've got climate scientists that are predicting that because of global warming, this is the new normal. We're going to see more devastating hurricanes. Towns along the coast are going to be devastated by more hurricanes. Florida is especially vulnerable. There is a big debate in Washington and Tallahassee about whether or not climate change is real. But for those people that are concerned about climate change, should we have a policy of not rebuilding in areas that might be prone to devastation from hurricanes?
Well, let me just say this. I think that everyone knows that climate change is real. It's the genesis of climate change. Is it man-made or is it cyclical? So I think that there is a universal movement towards that. But many years ago in the state of Florida, and I believe you were in the state legislature at the time, there was something called coastal construction control lines, okay, in which you had a very reasonable line that was moved past the edge of a waterway that produced more meaningful construction that was mindful of, you know, the ebbs and flows of a watershed area. We've allowed for the influence of individuals that contribute to our campaigns, of our elected officials who might have construction ties, and we all know who those people are in the state of Florida, to erode those coastal lines. And so that we ended up allowing for an enormous amount of building along our coast and too close to the waterway. We're a peninsula. You know, you can't ask the whole state of Florida to move out of state of Florida, but we can be very thoughtful, and we can actually put regulation in that allows for development, but smart development, sustainable development. And I think that's actually an idea that resonates both in Republicans and Democrats. They just have to get there.
Okay. Well, this weekend, the Florida Democrats will be holding their statewide convention in Orlando. And even though Florida is considered one of the most important swing states, none of the Democratic presidential hopefuls is planning to be there.
Instead, the candidates are taking part in the New Yorker Festival and an LGBTQ town hall in Los Angeles hosted by CNN and the Human Rights Campaign. Florida is always one of the most closely watched battleground states in presidential elections, and President Trump has repeatedly made appearances here, including his stop last week in the Villages, the GOP-friendly retirement community in Central Florida. The primary election calendar works against Democratic candidates spending large amounts of time here in the state this fall. Florida won't hold its primary until March 17th, long after key states such as Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina have held their caucuses and primaries.
All right. So I wish we had more time to answer this question. Mike, you're the only one that gets a shot at this.
Yes, sir.
All right. So does that mean that the Democrats have given up on Florida, or are they just preparing for Tuesday's debate in Ohio?
They have not given up in Florida. Certainly they want to make certain they can participate in whatever they're able to in the state of Florida. But again, as noted, it's a March primary of next year, and it's very possible, not probable, but very possible that the nominee will have already been selected by March of next year. Mm-hmm. And so they have to focus in on groups and also in areas of the country that are coming up sooner than later.
All right. Well, before we go, what other news stories should we be paying attention to? Mike, your other big story of the week.
Yeah, Colorado Governor Cory Gardner sadly had a hard time answering a simple question today. I should say yesterday, and that is, should the President of the United States ask a foreign leader if they to help them in an investigation of a political individual? And he had a tough time. Sadly, had a tough time just answering that question. You know, in politics, I learned something. If you can't answer a question, don't take the question. Mm-hmm. and move out of there real quick. And to watch that really was painful. And I think painful to Republicans and Democrats to watch an individual unable to answer a simple question.
All right. Tara, your other big story?
You know, in 4 weeks, St. Pete is having our municipal elections, and that will be the last time we can choose city council members before the next mayoral race in 2021. So it's going to be interesting. After those folks are selected, who's going to be jockeying to be the next mayor? Because we have a term-limited mayor. Absentee ballots have already gone out, so it's going to be interesting to watch who lines up to want to be the mayor of St. Pete.
All right. St. Petersburgers, go out and vote.
Yes,
all
please.
Right.
I think we really have to be watching Turkey and what we saw unfold with President Trump this week. And I really think what we're going to find is that this whole Turkey, Russia, Middle East is really not just about oil, but about water.
Okay.
And control.
Holly, your other big story.
Well, unfortunately, I think we have to keep an eye on the potential for red tide. It has been detected again off the southwest coast, and we know that it certainly can bloom in the fall months as well. The 17-month long bloom that impacted us here and all three coasts of Florida, that bloomed in November of 2017. So unfortunately, it's cropping back up in southwest Florida, so we got to keep an eye on
several
it.
Several outbreaks already.
Yep.
Very sad. All right. Well, thank you all for a wonderful show. And thank you for watching Florida This Week. Your comments are always welcome. Please write us at ftw@wedu.org and continue the conversation on Facebook.
Well, that was Florida This Week from this past Friday night on the PBS station WEDU-TV in Tampa. And my guests on that panel were Holly Gregory from Bay News 9. Rita Ferrandino was the Democrat on the panel. She's from Sarasota. And Mike Fasano was the Republican. He's the tax collector in Pasco County. And Tara Newsom was also on that panel. She's a professor, a lawyer, and she teaches political science at St. Pete College. And we talked about possibly seeing an increase for starting pay for teachers. Also, a federal judge, skeptical about the legislature's implementation of Amendment 4. That's the Felon Voting Rights Restoration Act. Also, we talked about the slow recovery from Hurricane Michael in the Florida Panhandle, and we talked about the Democrats not showing up, the Democratic presidential candidates not showing up for the Florida Democrats' annual convention in Orlando. And if you want to comment about the show, you can write us at dj@wmnf.org. You can also Call us up at 813-239-9663. David writes this. He says, I think the folks in Bay County and nearby counties need to rethink their support of President Trump and Governor DeSantis. I feel that these poor people have been failed repeatedly by the feds and the state. They need to speak with their votes and get rid of the dead meat. That's David's opinion. Tony's in St. Pete. He writes this. The legislature's majority brazen attack on the will of the voters on returning felon voting rights is just part of a deliberate strategy over the past two decades to suppress the popular vote. Tony goes on to write, look at the way that they've gerrymandered districts in this state to ensure GOP domination of the legislature, though there are slightly more Democrats registered in the state. The result is low worker pay, huge numbers of people without health insurance, and a growing environmental crisis. That's Tony's opinion in St. Petersburg. Suzanne writes this, I like Mike Fasano. I wish more Republicans were like Mike. I think the governor has asked for a raise for teachers so he can say he's a good governor. I'm sure he knows the legislature will not okay it, but he still will look good, like the good guy, even though I don't believe he is. That's Suzanne's opinion out there. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. And Anonymous from the 941 area code writes, the Florida state government needs to force the insurance companies, rather, not to allow the separate claims that water or wind, it's a hurricane, writes a 941. So I think we know what you mean, 941. Thank you for that. Well, there's some other issues in the news. I figured I'd bring them up, and then let's see where the conversation goes. You can always call us at 813-239-9663. The European Union has unanimously condemned Turkey's military move into northern Syria and has asked all member states to stop selling arms to Turkey. Spanish Foreign Minister Josep Borrell said in an interview with the Associated Press that the 28 European member states have unanimously decided to condemn, that is the verb, not concern, not worry, but to condemn in strong terms what in the end is a military attack. Borrell said the EU called on Turkey to stop immediately the military actions. He said at that meeting of the EU foreign ministers, the member states call also on member states to stop selling any kind of arms to Turkey. The U.S. appears to be headed toward a full military withdrawal from Syria amid the growing chaos, cries of betrayal, and signs that Turkey's invasion could fuel a broader war. The Trump administration defense secretary, Mark Esper, said yesterday that President Trump has directed U.S. troops in northern Syria to begin pulling out as safely and quickly as possible. And that's some of the news out there. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. In Fort Worth, Texas, a white police officer who fatally shot a 28-year-old black woman inside her Texas home is set to be interviewed by investigators as questions and outrage grow over the shooting. Fort Worth police say officers responded early Saturday after a neighbor called a non-emergency line to report the home's front door had been left open. The responding officer fired a shot through the home's window, killing the woman, Atitania Jefferson. And a family attorney says that Jefferson was playing video games with her 8-year-old nephew when she was killed. Jefferson graduated with a biology degree from Xavier University in New Orleans. And again, we can talk about any of these. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Police are deployed around Ukraine's capital as multiple far-right and nationalist groups gather for protests against President Zelensky and his peace plan for eastern Ukraine. Authorities expect tens of thousands of protesters at the nationalist demonstrations, which mark Defense of the Homeland Day. President Zelensky urged participants to avoid violence and warned of potential provocations from those who want to stoke chaos. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Even with no presidential candidate in sight at their state convention, Florida Democratic leaders say grassroots party members are energized to defeat President Trump next year. Party leaders admitted that in past years they have started late in fundraising and organizing, but they promised they weren't repeating that pattern this election cycle. The party chairwoman, Terry Rizzo, and executive director Juan Penalosa told reporters this weekend that they have a multimillion-dollar campaign to register 200,000 Democrats by the 2020 primary. And A video depicting a macabre scene of a fake President Trump shooting, stabbing, and brutally assaulting members of the news media and his political opponents was shown at a conference for his supporters at his Miami resort last week, according to footage obtained by the New York Times. Several of Trump's top surrogates, including his son, Donald Trump Jr., his former spokeswoman, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida, were scheduled to speak at the three-day conference, which was held by a pro-Trump group called American Priority at Trump National Doral in Miami. Sanders and a person close to Trump's son said on Sunday they did not see the video at the conference. The video, which includes the logo for Trump's 2020 re-election campaign, comprises a series of internet memes. The most violent clip shows Mr. Trump's head superimposed on the body of a man opening fire inside what's called the Church of Fake News. Let's listen to a little bit of this video. I think we can play it. This is the video that was shown last weekend at a Trump event, a pro-Trump event in South Florida.
Every single American tonight, you should be concerned about what we're learning. We're talking about abuse of power and corruption at the highest levels of the FBI.
The FBI was pulled.
And figures out tonight show nearly 2,000 children have been separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexican border from mid-April through the end of May.
How dare you separate them from their parents? We're going to rip your son from his mother's arms and throw him in a cage full of pedophiles and let them have...
The video now shows President Trump shooting people in a church, people that are described as ABC News, NPR, CBS. And here's the president or fake president shooting people in a church, shooting somebody with an Obama logo. And the mayhem just continues as people are just killed violently by this Trump character. Slate.com. Huffington Post, John McCain is killed in the church. BuzzFeed News is killed. Trump is killing dozens and dozens of people in this video that was shown. Apparently, New York Times and showed Trump is the Trump character is also shown killing politicians that have been critical of President Trump. 813-239-9663. The video, which is pretty gruesome, shows President Trump killing Mitt Romney and Mika Brzezinski. Anyway, that was the video shown at a conference for Trump supporters at his Miami resort last week, according to footage obtained by the New York Times. I'll send you a copy of the video if you want. You can email me here in the studio at dj@wmnf.org. It is very gruesome. And it's based, I think, on a film called The Kingsman, which I did not see. 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. Let's take some phone calls from listeners. Let's go to Chris in Sarasota. Chris, you're on. What's on your mind today?
Hey, hello. Thank you, Rob. I think this is, you know, the stuff with Syria and all going on is part of Trump's playbook for the election, that he has to be, he's going to start a war, and he's got to be here to control it.
Well, do you think it's under his control now? That's what I'm wondering. Is it that
he thinks it is.
Has he unleashed, for instance, the ISIS families and the ISIS fighters who've now apparently escaped, hundreds of them, at least 800, according to some news reports this morning. I mean, can he put that genie back in the bottle, or does he have to? You know, the other component of this is that he's sent somewhere around, and we're still not quite sure, 1,400 to 2,000 troops to Saudi Arabia. So does this tamp down war in that region, or does this increase the likelihood?
Escalates it.
That's what I think. I think it escalates it. I don't think it tamps it down.
Yeah.
So, if it is his game plan, if you say it's his game plan to run as the president, who's the chief, the commander in chief, rather, how does that help him if this is a war that he caused?
They'll figure something out. Republicans, you can't trust them. Just like the voter thing, you can't trust them, is the way I see it. There are good Republicans, but they're all, they're silent because of Trump. They're afraid of him.
I just don't understand how it helps. But you may be right, Chris. I mean, maybe there's a plan. I think the problem now is that you've widened a war that was, check because of the presence of the U.S. troops on that border between Turkey and Syria.
Right.
But now you've widened it. So how does that help?
Who knows?
Yeah. All right, Chris.
You're just making a bigger mess.
Yeah. Chris, thanks a lot. I mean, maybe there is a justification. I saw Rand Paul on television yesterday being interviewed on one of the cable news or one of the news channels, and Rand Paul was saying, well, the president did the right thing. But I'm not sure, if you want ISIS to be contained and you don't want ISIS spreading its ideology in that region or beheading more people, is this the right way to go? What do you think? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. And does the U.S. have any business sending troops to Saudi Arabia? So Saudi Arabia is not, is not an official ally of the U.S. We may get oil from it, but I don't think that we have a defense agreement with Saudi Arabia. So why are we sending somewhere between 1,400 and 2,000 troops to Saudi Arabia? What do you think? Especially people that support this idea, call us up. Let's see if we can get at least one supporter of this idea. 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. And this is Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. There's got to be some people that support the president. I'd like to hear what the rationale is for letting Turkey essentially attack the people who were our allies in the fight against ISIS over the last 5 years. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Jerry in Clearwater. Jerry, thank you for calling. What's up?
Thank you for taking my call. My family has been associated with Trump in the New York area, members of my family. And one of the reasons that he withdrew and one of the reasons he's been so fearful of his taxes being released. Back during the Nixon days, we used to have a saying called follow the money. This guy is mobbed up with the Russian mob all the way up to his ears. And this is going to give Russia the opportunity to save the world from ISIS. And it's going to make Russia look very good, which if you'll notice, the people that he sucked up to, he admires these people greatly. And he is tremendously indebted to Russian banks, the largest of which is controlled by the Russian mafia. And this is why in New York City, he only got 10% of the vote. Because they know him. And this is why my relative that I will not mention would not do business with him. Because, A, he has a habit of not paying people and then turning around and suing them. And, B, he is too damn close to the Russian mob. And that was 15 years ago.
Yeah. So are you saying that you have a relative who was stiffed by Donald Trump?
Well, a relative that Donald Trump attempted to do business with, who then investigated Donald Trump and chose not to come near him.
Okay. All right. Well,
and he is this relative who is now dead was on the board of directors of a major insurance company.
Okay. Well, and it's hard to prove that the guy's dead. Was there ever a newspaper article written about it or?
Oh, well, of course not. That's why he's not letting. That's why he's been so protective of his taxes.
Yeah. Okay.
Follow the money.
All right, Jerry.
The Russian bank is the largest money launderer in the world.
Yeah, well, I think there have been a lot of news stories and reports and rumors about that. I think the key for us is to find some proof. And if your relative was alive, if your relative was alive, that would be a lot easier to get your relative on the phone. That would be ideal if we could get your relative on the phone. And he or she described why they did not do business with President Trump and what their rationale was. That would really help us. But Jerry, thanks a lot. I really appreciate the phone call. Let's go to Ed in Largo. Ed, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, good morning, Bills. Hey, I called to find out. I'm actually backing Trump on this Syrian pullout. What would everybody have us do with all these ISIS detainees?
Hold them.
Get out of the quagmire. How do we back out and say, okay, now we've done our job of quelling your problem here. Now we're off. We've solved this to a degree where you should be able to handle it yourself. We can't keep on holding everybody. Just like our kids, when we raise our kids, when they leave our house, then it's up to them. Sure, we give them a hand. We help them out. We help us with their grandchildren. But we can't stay on top of them and hover every moment that
Ed, do you have any idea what the U.S. spends stationing military in Guam and Japan? Do you have any idea what we spend every year? How many of your tax dollars we spend?
No, I have not.
Just take a guess.
I would tend to say probably $5 billion.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. Whatever it is.
Oh yeah.
All right. So would you say that Japan presents any trouble to you or trouble to the peaceful world, or would you say that Guam presents any trouble to you or the peaceful world?
No, but I think
if you were to take that $5 billion. Space. If you were to take that $5 billion and bring it back home, it's probably not $5 billion, but it's a lot of money. If you were to take that money and bring it back home, wouldn't that be a better use of the money, right? But you, without thinking about it ever, you okay the people that spend all that money stationing troops in Japan where we don't have trouble? Why not help the Kurds hold these 800 ISIS people behind bars so they can't wreak havoc in that part of the world? It's certainly not costing us $5 billion, I can tell you that. And with the Kurds helping out, it might cost a few million a year. Wouldn't you say that that ISIS presents a much graver threat to peaceful people around the world, and they should be kept in check, whereas, you know, we have hundreds and hundreds of U.S. military installations abroad, and most people, including you, don't think a minute about all the billions that we spend with the U.S. around the world. If we were going to spend any money on the military, wouldn't spending money to control or contain ISIS, wouldn't that be a good use of our money?
I wholeheartedly agree. Would you not think that how long do we?
Well, you remember World War II ended in 1945, and we still have troops in Japan.
Correct.
Yeah. So, you know, and Japan has been peaceful for the last umpteen years, right? So why, you know, if you're going to spend military money, why not spend it on people that are currently violent?
Is Japan at peace because we have a base there?
Japan's at peace because it has joined the modern world, and they are not going back. They're not itching for a fight. Japan is not itching for a fight. Ed, thanks a lot. Thanks for the great call. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Don in Largo. Don, you're on. What would you like to say?
The guy that said follow the money, it's so apropos. Trump has said on national TV, like he said about Russians go get Hillary's emails, that he really loves Saudi Arabia because they give him money. And in Turkey, there's a big hotel with Trump's name on it. It's the biggest Trump properties there in Turkey. Turkey gives Trump money. Saudi Arabia gives Trump money, and so Turkey can do annihilate the Kurds, and Saudi Arabia can annihilate Yemen. You know, it's so simple. The idea that the Constitution says that you ought not have a position of trust if you take money from foreign governments. He takes money from foreign governments, and he helps the foreign governments that he takes money from. He proposed a Muslim ban on those countries, Muslim countries that didn't give him money. But those that give him money, they're just swell, even though we were attacked by 17 people from Saudi Arabia. It really is so simple and mind-numbing how simple it is.
And when the president commits troops to Saudi Arabia, under what authority is he committing troops to Saudi Arabia? I mean, we're not going to war. No, there's been no declaration of war. The president keeps saying, over the weekend, he's been saying, well, if you want to protect the Kurds, have a declaration of war. Well, he's not asking for a declaration of war on behalf of Saudi Arabia, so I think the president can't have it both ways. We can't send 1,400 troops to Saudi Arabia and say, well, the president has the authority to do this, but then the president says, well, we have no interest in protecting the Kurds who were once our allies for 5 years. It's just an odd thing that the president is doing.
Well, he can make a phone call to Saudi Arabia and says, I'm sending 1,400 folks there. And Saudi Arabia says, we'll say, swell, I'll give you money. There's no historical precedent or constitutional precedent for a president to be receiving funds and doing inside trading for his own interests.
Yeah, you know, certainly like not at this level, yeah.
The Scotland Air Force Base and the G7 summit meeting at his place, and the Sprint and T-Mobile booking big hotel reservations at his place in D.C. when they were being getting ready to get approved for that merger. It's just so much inside. What's her name, the famous towel person? You know, she was indicted. She served time in jail because she got a hot tip from somebody on an airplane. But he's doing purposeful inside trading all the time.
Yeah. All right. So, Don, thanks a lot. Thanks for the phone call. Great to hear from you. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Sharon in St. Petersburg. Hi, Sharon. You're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, good morning, Rob. I would just like to mention to the listeners that David K. Johnston has been writing books and researching Donald Trump for quite a few years. And if you just pick up one, I think he has six or seven now, but if you just pick up one of them, you'll see what the mindset of this man. And he's just not to be trusted. I think he's the biggest con man I've ever seen in office. And anyway, so just wanted to share that information.
All right, Sharon, thanks a lot. Yeah, David K. Johnson's been on this show. We played a bunch of speeches by him over the last 10 years, and he's been interviewed a couple of times on Radioactivity, so he's a good person to pay attention to. 813-239-9663. Here's an anonymous email. This says, by his silence, Trump has conceded democracy in Hong Kong to China. By his words, he has betrayed our allies in Europe and conceded the Middle East to Russia. Not an American president, writes Imad. That's okay, so it was signed. 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. Robin Thanotis-Assa says, that base in Japan is there to protect Japan from China, not to protect the world from Japan. That's Robin Thanotis-Assa. Yeah, I don't know, Rob. China was not much of a power at all in the 1960s and 70s, and yet we had quite a military installation in Japan. So I'm still wondering why it's there and why we have some 800 or 900 bases and military installations across the world. And not all of them are in dangerous places, Japan being one of them, Guam being another. We have military bases in places that are quite peaceful. So what's if we're worried about spending our money, and if you want to spend money protecting people who are civilians who are being slaughtered, wouldn't it be better to spend a few million protecting people from ISIS? That was my point. I hope that was clear. Well, if you want to make a comment about today's show, call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And we'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. And now stay tuned for Sean Cannan. He's coming up next with the Midpoint program. He'll be featuring a talk by Russell Means, the leader of the American Indian Movement. And he'll be talking about Columbus and the founding by the European settlers of North and South America and the Caribbean and Central America, and the changes that were brought by those explorers. That's coming up in the next hour right here on WMNF in Tampa, this on Indigenous Peoples Day. Thanks for listening. This is WMNF Tampa. Thanks to